Good day. Today is Sunday, 17th May 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, over the last 12 hours or so, Ukraine, in response, as President Zelensky claims, has been conducting its own big drone strike against Russia, targeting specifically the city of Moscow. And there have indeed been waves of Ukrainian drones, hundreds of quantities, heading towards Moscow. And President Zelensky, for his part, and as I will come to shortly, has published an very interesting, very defiant statement. Now, a number of things to be said about this drone attack immediately. Hundreds of drones are involved. If you count numbers of drones, then, well, this is an attack comparable in scale to the attacks that the Russians launch against Ukraine. But in some respects, in fact, in all respects, that merely highlights the difference. Because whilst Ukrainian air defences clearly are now struggling to counter Russian drones, Geran drones, the Russians still retain an extremely effective air defence system. In fact, my sense is that it's getting all the time more sophisticated and better adapted at dealing with drones. And that becomes very obvious when you compare the effect of Russian drone attacks with this particular drone attack, which is the biggest that Ukraine has managed to conduct up to now. So even though we are talking about hundreds of drones, some are giving a figure of up to 600 drones. The number of drones that are actually getting through appears to be relatively few. There have been some damage done to some residential buildings, and I understand around 4 people, civilians that we know of, have been killed. Airports around Moscow have been closed whilst the drone attack is underway. And there has been an attack and a fire at one refinery in Moscow. But when you put it all together, the amount of damage doesn't seem to be especially great. And the mayor of Moscow, Sergei Sobyanin, who is incidentally acknowledged in Russia to be a tough and very effective administrator and someone who seems to enjoy wide support and confidence amongst Muscovites. Anyway, he says that the Russian air defences have successfully repelled the attack. He says that the damage to the refinery, though it has happened, has not been so great as to disrupt production, despite the pictures of the fire. And, well, my own contacts in Moscow tell me that the normal life of the city continues and does so, well, not entirely unaffected. The airports have, of course, closed, but without very much visible damage and with minimal effect to the operation of the economy. Now, that is absolutely not the case when Russians conduct attacks against targets in Ukraine. We've had many attacks on Kiev. These have done significant damage to Kiev's industrial plants. There's no word that any of the major industrial plants around Moscow have been significantly affected. And, well, we've had long periods of electricity shortages, and during the winter of water shortages, and even food shortages in Kiev following Russian attacks on the city, but nothing remotely comparable in relation to Moscow. So a huge attack by Ukraine, but one which the Russians have demonstrated that they're able to counter. I come back to a point I have made many times. Given the enormous resources that are committed by Ukraine to conducting these drone attacks on Russia, and given the relatively minimal damage that these attacks do, this does all have about it something of the sense of a major misallocation of resources that Ukraine and its European allies and the Americans are giving an enormous amount of time and energy and resources in order to conduct drone strikes inside Russia, when proportionately the results of all this effort are relatively few. So to me, this doesn't make very much military sense, especially a country like Ukraine, especially Ukraine's Western sponsors, who are increasingly short of equipment. One might think might be using the resources they still have on achieving more effective things, like, for example, stabilizing the critical shortages in artillery shells on the front line, perhaps developing more effective first-person view drones on the front lines. Ukrainians have never successfully mastered fiber optic technology to the extent that the Russians have done, for example. Anyway, to achieve these things, rather than to send huge numbers of drones towards Moscow, of which the vast majority apparently are shot down, and the few that do get through manage to do relatively slight damage. Now, in saying all of this, I ought to correct something that I said in a program a few days ago. I said that Ukrainian drones are relatively small. I was corrected by a viewer about this. He described to me the large size of some of the Ukrainian drones, which enables them to travel long distances deep inside Russia. And these drones do, in fact, strongly resemble light airplanes. They are very different in configuration and technology from the far more refined and, I suspect, much more stealthy Garand drones that the Russians use. But I think, nonetheless, even allowing for this, for the fact that I got the size of some of these drones wrong, the main point I was making still holds. The warhead these drones carry is small, and the damage they can do against industrial facilities is light. You need many more drones attacking one target, getting through to do damage. You need to be much more selective in which attacks, in what you attack with your drones. You need to have far more control over the way you use drones in order to be able to use them as effectively as the Russians do, or as effectively as the Iranians up to now have done. Ideally, you should supplement your drones with missiles, which the Ukrainians have been unable to do. And, well, in technological terms, again, and by the way, operational terms, again, if you compare the two drone offensives, you can see immediately and very quickly the differences. Now, having made these points of mine, which are based on my own observation and which I'm sure some people would want to contest, I'm going to turn to Zelensky's statement following this drone attack, because it seemed to me to be very interesting in that it suggested that there had been arguments about these drone attacks by Ukraine against Russia, arguments which can only be taking place between the Ukrainians and the Americans. And this is what Zelensky said in a post he's published on X. Our responses to Russia's prolongation of the war and its attacks on our cities and communities are entirely justified. That this time, Ukrainian long-range sanctions reached the Moscow region, and we're clearly telling the Russians their state must end its war. Ukrainian drone and missile manufacturers continue their work. I'm grateful to the Security Service of Ukraine and all the defense forces of Ukraine for their precision. The distance from Ukraine's border is over 500 kilometers. The concentration of Russian air defense in the Moscow region is the highest, but we are overcoming it. Now, that's what he said, but the most interesting part of this comment is in the first sentence. Our responses to Russia's prolongation of the war and its attacks on our cities and communities are entirely justified. Now, who exactly are those words addressed to? To the Russians? Well, obviously, they're not going to pay any attention. On the contrary, what I'm hearing from Russia is that these Ukrainian drone attacks just harden will inside Russia and lead to demands from people in Russia not to end the war, but in fact to escalate it. In fact, there has been a recent interview by the Russian ambassador, Dmitry Polyansky, who I should say I slightly know. I've never met him in person. We've never had any private conversations with each other, but I have interviewed him on programs on the Duran on a number of occasions. And by the way, at this point, I should say that I was very impressed by his force of personality, which is something that only comes across to you when you are actually interviewing someone and may not be conveyed to the full extent to those who might be watching the interview, just to say. But anyway, Polyansky has said that the Russians are very well aware of what the Europeans have been up to and of the role they have played in Ukraine's drone offensive against Russia, that the Russians have shown extraordinary forbearance up to now in relation to Europe's role in these drone attacks on Russia, that Russia's forbearance should not, however, be misconstrued for weakness, and Russian patience is wearing thin, and if this pattern continues, the possibility for an escalation is certainly there. An escalation, a counter-escalation by the Russian side is certainly there. Anyway, that is Polyansky's words. I think I am paraphrasing them correctly. And they, again, perhaps highlight the fact that in Moscow, it is President Putin and the team around him, who continue to argue for a more measured and moderate and incremental approach to the war, whereas demands for an escalation of the war, for an intensification of attacks on Ukraine, are mounting. So Zelensky's words are obviously not addressed to the Russians. I cannot imagine that he's not aware, at least to some extent, of all of this. So if they're not addressed to the Russians, and they're not going to have the effect on the Russians that he says, persuade them to end the war on Ukrainian terms, then who are these words addressed to? Who does Zelensky want to justify? And that's a word he uses in his first sentence. He wants to justify these Ukrainian attacks too. Well, I'm going to suggest that the only party is the United States. The Europeans have shown no inhibitions in supporting this Ukrainian drone offensive. They're not only aiding it, but they're cheering it on. And the German Defense Minister, Boris Pistorius, was recently in Kiev, where he entered into some kind of agreement or some promise of an agreement with Zelensky for German-Ukrainian cooperation in drones. So it seems to me that it is the United States. And of course, the United States is critical to this endeavor. Drone attacks deep inside Russia are only practical, as we learnt from an article last year in the New York Times, if they are undertaken with American intelligence and guidance assistance, which, following a series of decisions that President Trump made in the late spring and summer of 2025, has been provided. So what is all this about then? Well, I am going to suggest that what we saw over the last 12 hours, this Ukrainian drone attack on Moscow, is what Zelensky and some of his officials had been planning on the 9th of May during the Victory Day parade. A massive attack involving hundreds of drones, some of which conceivably Zelensky might have hoped would get through and strike the parade itself, and which he appeared to be threatening right up to the day before the parade itself took place. And in fact, we know what actually happened, that President Putin of Russia telephoned President Trump on the 29th of April, that President Putin warned President Trump that if an attack like that, like the one we've just seen, did take place on the 9th of May, then there would be massive Russian retaliation in response, targeting central Kiev. And what then happened is that President Trump heeded the Russian warning, which included warnings about possible damage to US and Western diplomatic premises, and potentially the deaths of diplomats, including Western diplomats, in Kiev. And President Trump told Zelensky to back off, and President Trump then went further than that and announced himself a ceasefire covering the 9th May holiday, which he imposed on President Zelensky. And this message that Zelensky has just posted on X tells you his extreme anger and resentment at the way in which the Americans put the leash on Ukraine and on him over those critically important days in May. And well, he's now launched his attack on Moscow, the one he couldn't launch on the 9th of May. Obviously, more than a week has passed since then, but he's now done it. But of course, it doesn't have anything like the kind of impact that it would have had, had it been launched on the 9th of May. And you could see his resentment and his anger boiling over. And I'm going to suggest also that this attack that the Ukrainians have done, again, casts a further light on Zelensky's previous comments about how the Russians would henceforth begin hunting the Ukrainian leadership, would start attacking the decision-making centres in Kiev, would seek to kill him personally and decapitate the entire Ukrainian leadership. I said that there was a definite element of panic about those words, which, by the way, I still maintain there was. He's clearly been unsettled by news from the battlefronts, by the news that Liman is falling and that Barova on the east bank of the Oskol near Izium has been captured by the Russians. And by the way, on that, there is now video footage from Barova, which does indeed show Russian troops inside Barova, apparently corroborating Gerasimov's claims. Anyway, there is undoubtedly alarm and fear from Zelensky about this, and he's clearly very worried about the Russian build-up in Belarus, and I will come to that shortly. But he's also worried that these kind of attacks, which nonetheless compulsively he insists on making against Moscow, might indeed invite the kind of retaliation directed specifically at him, which the Russians warned about before the attack on the 9th of May. You might almost say that by conducting this drone attack this time, Zelensky is almost inviting, goading the Russians to come after him, which, given his strange personality, discussed at length by Yulia Mendel in her recent interview with Tucker Carlson, I have to say, doesn't surprise me at all. Now, that then brings us to the other question of why, if this doesn't serve any military purpose, this attack doesn't serve any military purpose, and it doesn't serve any psychological purpose, why does Ukraine, why does Zelensky insist on conducting it? Well, the short answer, as far as I'm concerned, is that it is very like Ukrainian shelling on the city of Donetsk, which continued for many years after the 2014 crisis, and which basically only finished in, I think it was 2024, 2025, following the Russian capture of the town of Krasnogorovka, close to Donetsk. And I think that the reason for these attacks is psychological, but the psychology is more intended domestically for Ukraine and for Zelensky himself and for his inner circle to prove to themselves that they're still hitting back at the Russians, even as the war continues to go bad for them. And of course, it also has a performative effect, something discussed at length by Yulia Mendel in that interview. It gives the appearance of some enormous dramatic operation carried out against Russia, even if there isn't that much substance behind it. Yulia Mendel said something about Zelensky. I mean, this is obviously a quote of hers. I wasn't there. I'm not able to corroborate what she says here. But according to her, she once heard Zelensky said that facts themselves are not important. Supposedly, if you have 1,000 people saying what the facts are, that is more important because that is what shapes the facts. So, conduct an attack with many drones against Moscow. The amount of damage you do is slight. You're using up a lot of resources to carry it out. You are diverting the SBU, Ukraine's intelligence agency, and the Ukrainian Defense Ministry from other more pressing things. But you have the attack. You can publish posts about it on X. You can get the media in the West to write and talk about these things. And that is more important than the substance of the war itself. And well, if you could do it on Victory Day, that would have been more important still. But since you can't, you couldn't, you weren't allowed to do it on Victory Day, well, you might as well do it now. Well, I've spent some time discussing all of this attack and Zelensky's post, because I think it is indicative of the man and of the way he is leading Ukraine in this war. And well, now I'm going to discuss other things, which is indeed a number of decisions that President Putin and his government have been taking in Moscow, which are going to unsettle or have already unsettled Western governments. Firstly, yesterday, President Putin made a decree which allows citizens of Moldova, particularly as I understand it, citizens of Moldova who live in Transnistria, to acquire Russian passports. Now, this is a very unsettling thing for the Moldovan authorities and indeed for the European authorities. It is well remembered in Ukraine, in Europe, and in Moldova itself that one of the first indicators in 2014 that the crisis in Ukraine involving Russia was intensifying was when the Russians began to simplify the ability of Ukrainian citizens in Donbass to obtain Russian passports. And over the course of the following years, between 2014 and the start of the special military operation in 2022, more and more people in Donbass did indeed start to obtain Russian passports. So Putin now doing the same thing with respect to Moldova inevitably is going to make the government of Maria Sandu in Moldova and European governments nervous that once Ukraine is resolved, the crisis in Ukraine is resolved, Moldova is next. And all of this is juxtaposed with the passage through the Duma or the Russian parliament of a law that has been discussed extensively in Russia, which enables Putin to deploy the Russian army outside Russia without first getting approval from the Duma, from the Russian parliament, in circumstances where Russian citizens are threatened. So one could see what is happening. Since the re-election last year of Maria Sandu as president of Moldova, Moldova has continued its drive to integrate with the West. Maria Sandu makes no secret of her hostility to Russia and of her desire to fully reintegrate Transnistria to the rest of Moldova, to bring it firmly under central government control in Moldova. But Putin and the Russians are now giving a clear hint that if such a thing is done, Sandu and the Moldovan authorities and their European backers potentially invite a military counter from Russia. Now, that, however, does beg further questions, because Russia has no border with Moldova. Ukraine lies in between. And, well, how exactly would the Russian military intervene in Moldova to protect Russian citizens there? Well, there is a Russian peacekeeping force in Moldova, which has been in Moldova ever since the Transnistria crisis began in the 1990s. But it is very small. I understand that it numbers fewer than 1,000 men. And, well, it is cut off from Russia. So nominally it is there, but for the moment at least, there's no simple way that the Russian military can assist it. There are potential options. There are things that the Russians could do. They could conduct drone and missile strikes against Moldova. An extraordinary escalation, by the way, and I wonder whether that is indeed part of the plan. It would create a major crisis in Europe if they did, and I don't get the sense that President Putin and his officials are currently looking to provoke that sort of crisis. So what exactly is it that the Russians would do, given, as I said, that for the moment Ukraine lies between Russia and the regions in Moldova, which the Russian army might want to intervene in and protect. Well, could it be that the timing of this decree and of the law authorizing use of force implicitly in Moldova, and by the way, potentially also the Baltic states, that this series of laws has been passed to prepare for something that the Russians are not planning to do tomorrow or this year, but fairly soon, when they expect the war in Ukraine to end and them to have won? In other words, should we see these laws and decrees, especially as they pertain to Moldova, should we see in them a sign that Putin expects that his armies are going to achieve victory in Ukraine, perhaps this year, perhaps early next year, but anyway, relatively soon. Soon enough to make an intervention in Moldova to protect Russians there a viable option? Well, I don't know. I don't get briefed by the Kremlin about its thinking. But it does seem to me that that possibility is indeed real enough. And I would have thought that in Moldova and in Europe, they need to be paying attention. It is not impossible that, as in the absence of a proper negotiated resolution of all of these conflicts, of the one in Ukraine, of the one potentially in Moldova, it could very well be that the crisis is actually only beginning, that the Ukraine crisis is going to expand to become the Moldovan crisis as well. In which case, I have to say that the situation in Europe is going to become even more critical than it looks as if it might become already. Now, Putin himself remains very busy, and he's also planning shortly a trip to China. We've now been provided the dates, 19th to 20th of May. So he's going to be flying to China next week. I suspect that preparations for this trip have been taking up a significant amount of his time. I am going to suggest that the Chinese and the Russians have been in very close communication with each other throughout the last few days, including during the time of President Trump's visit to China. I suspect that whilst that visit to China was underway, the Russians were getting from the Chinese regular updates of what was going on and of what was being said. I suspect that Putin is going to bring a massive delegation with him, including many government ministers. And I suspect that major deals will be done, in striking contrast to the lack of deals that were done during President Trump's visit. On that, by the way, there have been some claims, well, there have been reports in Bloomberg and such places, that the Chinese Commerce Ministry has given some indications that China is indeed now working on arrangements to start buying Boeing aircraft. I have to say that the language used, the terminology used, seemed to me to leave the possibility open. China might buy Boeings, or then it might not, then again, it might not. For the record, China now is moving forward with a very ambitious civil aerospace program of its own. It's working on its own wide-bodied aircraft, with which, by the way, it has previously been working with the Russians, and there's some talk that that arrangement might be revived. There's work on developing high bypass turbofan engines to power this aircraft, both in Russia and in China. The Chinese very soon are no longer going to need to buy Boeings. It may be that they will decide to buy some Boeings to keep their airlines up to date during the transitional period before these Chinese aircraft start to appear. But if they do, I'm going to guess that it will be the last big Chinese purchase, or maybe not even that big. It'll be the last Chinese purchase of American passenger jets. I think that the United States is about to lose that market, the Chinese market, for its civil aviation once and for all, and that this is going to happen fairly soon, certainly within the next 5 years. But anyway, Putin will no doubt also go to Beijing. He will want to find out from Xi Jinping personally what the nature of Xi Jinping's interactions with Trump. And he will no doubt want to know from Xi Jinping how Xi Jinping feels Trump reacted to the very strong warning Xi Jinping gave Trump over Taiwan. But I am going to guess that the Russians also are going to want to brief the Chinese, or are going to be expected by the Chinese to brief them about their military moves in the conflict in Ukraine. Now, there have been further developments on the battlefronts over the last 24 hours. For one thing, even as the Ukrainians were conducting their own drone strike at Moscow, the Russians conducted again their own big drone strike against Ukraine. Fewer drones, apparently around 300, but nonetheless, a powerful strike. These strikes happen every day and night now, and of course, they extend to every part of Ukraine, which, because of the enormous size of Russia, Ukrainian drone strikes against Russia cannot do. They cannot cover every part of Russia. Anyway, so there has been more operations in the sky, and the Russians have been continuing to move forward on various parts of the battlefronts. I now had an opportunity to read through Gerasimov's briefing, and it appears that the Russians are now advancing well to the west of Kupiansk. There's still, I notice, no recognition in the media in the West that Kupiansk is fully under Russian control, and that the Ukrainian counterattack there, well, all that has now ended. But as well as this, it seems as if there's been a significant dialing up of the attacks in Zaporozhye, that the Russians have been pushing forward and are now close to capturing a village called Vozvizhenka, which is not to be confused, by the way, with the village of Vozvizhenka located near Pokrovsk, which the Russians captured, well, a long time ago, before the fall of Pokrovsk. But anyway, the Russians seem to be close to capturing this village at another village called Guliapolske, also in this area. In fact, the Russians now seem to be very close to the eastern outskirts of Orekhov. And the battle for Orekhov has essentially, as far as I can see, already begun. And yesterday I discussed the implications of the fall of Barova and what Gerasimov has said about the Russians being in control of 85% of Liman, close to Slavyansk, in the north of Donetsk. But, well, as regularly happens, I've now received from a source with access to information inside Russia, again, I choose my names, words very carefully, an extensive amount of information about what is indeed going on in Belarus and in the north. Now, after Zelensky, as I discussed in my program yesterday, spoke about possible Russian military operations against Kiev from Belarus, and also spoke of the possibility of Belarus joining the war against Ukraine. And by the way, Zelensky's comments here were repeated by his former foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, who also says that Belarus is now close to joining the war. I don't believe that, by the way, but never mind. Well, after Zelensky made those comments, the Ukrainian military itself, I believe it was General Gnatov, the chief of general staff in Ukraine. Anyway, he came out and said that there is no reason at the moment to worry about an immediate attack from Belarus. The situation along the Belarus border is currently stable. So another example, by the way, of General Gnatov, if it was him, directly contradicting Zelensky, something which General Gnatov has already done more than once. But in fact, as I understand it, at least as this information I've obtained suggests, Zelensky's comments are not wholly groundless. I don't know the full number of Russian troops in Belarus. My guess is that they number no more than a few thousand. But it does seem as if the roads and railway links, lines and the logistic preparations are being made in Belarus, potentially for a much bigger deployment soon. And what I've also heard is that the Russians, that the total force of the two reserve armies that the Russians can potentially launch in this area numbers around 150,000 men. And the source provided me with a detailed assessment of the state of the reserve armies. And the reserve armies I've just talked about are just some of the reserve armies that the Russians have been building up and creating. Ever since the decision was made to set up the reserve armies in the autumn of 2022. And interestingly, it is the reserve armies rather than the army in the field, the army that is fighting in Ukraine. It is the various reserve armies which have been kept in Russia, which are getting the best of the equipment that the military industrial complex in Russia has been churning out. So they are the people who are getting the T-90 tanks and the BMP-3 infantry fighting vehicles, and who are getting the most advanced artillery. The forces on the front lines make do with older equipment, T-72s, and equipment of that kind. And though that is considered more than adequate for the war, it is the reserve armies that are being equipped and trained. And apparently the training and organization of these reserve armies is an enormous undertaking. It is these reserve armies which are being equipped and trained for some kind of future operation, with much speculation as to what that is. And to repeat again, when I spoke about the 150,000 men, this applies only to one part of this military, this army that is being developed inside Russia. There are other reserve armies as well, which I'm not going to talk about because I don't know much about them. But I understand that they're being trained and equipped and manned in the same way. And around 80% of the men in these armies now have combat experience fighting in Ukraine. And units from these armies are regularly rotated to the battlefronts, where they gain experience of working together as a unit in actual battle. And there's all sorts of plans as to how these armies should fight and work. Lots of work on developing both their drone and their anti-drone capabilities, for example. And, well, it does look as if the reserve armies are becoming a potent force, but one which has not been used by the Russians up to now. Now, back last year, I said that I expected that these reserve armies, about whose existence, by the way, there is no doubt. I've seen them discussed in in mainstream media outlets. I expected these reserve armies to be used at some point in the ongoing war in Ukraine itself. I thought they might be used last year in Ukraine, but that didn't happen. Now, I wonder whether the plan is to break through Donbass, to capture all of Donbass, which is what the existing military are doing, to capture Orekhov and potentially Zaporozhye, for Putin to then give his ultimatum to Ukraine, telling the Ukrainians that now that they've lost Donbass and lost Zaporozhye, they've clearly lost the war, and it is time for them to make peace. And these are his new terms, which will go further than the terms that he outlined on the 14th of June 2022. And then, if the Ukrainians don't accept these terms, that's when the reserve armies might be unleashed with an attack on Kiev itself, possibly taking place in part through Belarus. And I remember that again last year, none other than Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, tried to impress upon some Ukrainian journalists that he was talking to that the Russians had created a reserve force of around 200,000 men who, if Ukraine did not go to achieve peace with, would indeed be deployed against Ukraine at some point in the war. And bear in mind that number, 200,000 men, is of the same order of magnitude as the 150,000 men of these two reserve armies that I've just been discussing. So perhaps Zelensky knows about this. Perhaps that partly explains his nervousness and his fear. Because to be straightforward about this, I think that especially if Donbass is lost, I doubt that Ukraine has any ability to withstand a Russian commitment of 250,000 fully trained veteran soldiers into the battle, but possibly moving towards Kiev itself and placing the situation in Kiev in jeopardy on a completely different level than what we saw in 2022. But anyway, I don't want to speculate too much about this. It is interesting to learn about this steady build-up of Russian reserves, just to say. It is one of the great enigmas of the war, why the Russians are holding back their reserves, just as another enigma of the war is why the Russians still don't attack the bridges across the Dnieper, of which they have every capability to do, and which they have demonstrated, by the way. Perhaps they do intend to use these reserve armies in exactly the way that I've said. Perhaps they don't want to destroy the Dnieper bridges because they plan at some point to use them themselves. That would be logical. But again, ultimately, I can only guess, because to repeat once more, the Russian General Staff and the Kremlin don't share their secrets with me. One party, though, which will, I am sure, want to know what it is exactly that the Russians are intending, are the Chinese. It will be very interesting to see who exactly is going with Putin to Beijing this week, this coming week, whether there will be any military officials there and who they are. I recall that there was a large number of Chinese military officials present in Moscow on Victory Day, and they were noticeable at the Victory Parade on Red Square. So there is intense liaison between the two militaries. And anyway, we will see what the eventual developments from all of this are. But one thing I am certain is that the Chinese will want to be briefed thoroughly about it. So that's where we are for the moment in the war. There will be more Russian drone strikes on Ukraine. I think for the moment, Putin probably still calculates that a direct retaliation against the West of the kind that's been talked about does not serve Russian interests at this time. The Russian objective always has been to confine the war as much as possible to the territory of Ukraine itself, not to extend its geographical reach more widely, which would simply disperse Russian resources and escalate the risks to an extraordinary degree. But as I said, Russian power, military power, is increasing. And as we saw from the program by Polyansky, there is undoubtedly within Moscow pressure on Putin to escalate, and it is growing. Of course, at the extreme end of that pressure is Professor Karaganov, who has been, I noticed, extremely busy on various channels explaining his views. He sometimes, it seems to me, comes very close to suggesting that the situation between Russia and the West, Russia and Europe, is now so bad that the Russians should actually plan for and consider using nuclear weapons. I don't think, as I said, there's anyone in Moscow who at the moment shares that view, just to say. But, well, the fact that these pressures do exist should not be discounted. Meanwhile, Dmitry Peskov, Putin's spokesman, has talked about negotiations. He says that the Russians have no interest in conducting negotiations with the Europeans. So far, the only format for talks is the one that exists involving Ukraine and the United States. The Russians certainly do not see any real movement in Europe such as would make talks worthwhile. And, well, Peskov was also completely mocking of the idea that Europe's chief negotiator should be, of all people, Kaya Kallas. Peskov seemed to regard that idea as completely absurd. Basically, he said, well, I'll quote his words, "It is in Kaya Kallas' interests not to be a negotiator. She won't have an easy time. If you remember, President Putin said that it could generally be anyone who hasn't managed to say a lot of bad things." So that's Peskov basically saying that Kaya Kallas is absolutely not wanted. She's almost the last person the Russians would want to see as a negotiator on Europe's behalf. And if the Europeans do decide to appoint her their chief negotiator, well, she's going to have a very, very tough time of it if she ever ends up, comes to Moscow. And frankly, reading Peskov's words, I am not sure that the Russians would even agree to meet with her at all. Now, before I finish talking about these things, I'm just going to do a very quick roundup on economic news. The Russians, Rostat, the the Russian Statistical Agency, has now published data on the performance of the Russian economy in the first quarter, January, February, March, and the overall decline was 0.2%, which is better than the 0.3% that had been reported a few days ago, and certainly does not suggest any kind of crisis in the economy overall. And Rostat has also provided information about inflation and the rate of inflation in Russia on an annualized basis is now 5.58%. There was significant deflation, in other words, a fall in prices for many foodstuffs. I not only think that the inflation crisis in Russia that we saw in 2024-2025 is over, but I think there is a real possibility that we're going to see deflation in overall in the summer, and that the central bank might find yet again that it has overshot its inflation target, and that inflation actually falls below its target of 4% in any year. Now, I'm going to suggest that the economy took up most of Putin's time, more of Putin's time last year than the war itself, the day-to-day management of the war, which I think Putin is content to leave in Gerasimov's hands. There was a big inflation spike in 2024-2025 as a result of overheating in the economy. Both Putin and his central bank chair, Nebulina, are always extremely sensitive to this based on their experiences in the last years of the Soviet Union and in the 1990s. They would have been very, very keen to bring inflation back firmly under control. I suspect that there's been lots of difficult and angry meetings about this over the last year in Moscow. I think that with inflation now definitely under control, and with interest rates falling and growth rising later in the year, I think we're going to see Putin taking a more active role in the diplomacy over Ukraine and other things as well. But a diplomacy which I don't think is going to be much concerned with President Trump or the United States. That's my view. Anyway, in the meantime, speaking about the United States, it looks as if the situation in the Gulf is back deteriorating again. The Iranians put their 10-point proposals to the Americans about 10 days ago, as I remember. The Americans now have come back with a 5-point proposal, which, as far as I can see, is the same proposals that they made on nuclear enrichment for a long time, and which are unacceptable to the Iranians. An end of Iranian enrichment, Iran agreeing to hand over all of its nuclear material to the United States, Iran agreeing to limit itself to one nuclear facility, Iran giving up its demand for reparations from the United States, Iran agreeing to a return to the situation with the Strait of Hormuz, such as existed on the 28th of February. I cannot imagine the Iranians agreeing to demands of this kind. And in fact, they've already said that they regard these demands as completely unacceptable. And in a sign of where the Iranians, which party the Iranians now are going to start to look to further, Ghalibaf, the speaker of the Iranian parliament, who has been the chief negotiator, who was the chief negotiator in the recent talks with the Americans in Pakistan, Ghalibaf has just been appointed in Iran as Iran's chief liaison with China. So the Iranians are going to be focusing increasingly on China, and I've no doubt on Russia too. Ghalibaf probably focusing on China, Araghchi on Russia, but it doesn't look as if the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz is going to be resolved anytime soon. What the president and his officials plan about Iran is, I have absolutely no idea. Perhaps we will drift back towards military action, a ground operation against Iran. But as I've said previously, that's not going to happen before the autumn, in my view, by which time the situation in the global economy will be very poor and the Republicans will likely have lost control of the House. So the United States, various US officials have now spoken about Taiwan, the Taiwan issue, after Xi Jinping's demand and warning made to Trump over the course of the meeting in Beijing. Secretary Rubio has said that whatever it was that the Chinese said, it's not going to change US policy towards Taiwan. That suggests that hardliners like him are going to continue to insist that the United States move ahead with a massive arms transfer to Taiwan. There's been an astonishingly belligerent article about Taiwan in the Daily Telegraph by John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor during his first term. Bolton continues to insist that weapons must be supplied to Taiwan and that the Chinese, in a sense, in effect, are bluffing in what they're saying. I'm afraid that the president has repeatedly shown a strong inclination to listen to people who talk like this to him. And this might indeed be the advice that he will follow, in which case we are going to see a major escalation of the crisis over Taiwan within the next few months. And yes, it is true that some kind of document is apparently being prepared, or some kind of strategy paper is being prepared, as between the Chinese and the Americans, for some kind of understanding of how their relationship should work in future. The Chinese often come up with these ideas for such for such frameworks. I could see why the Chinese might want to suggest such a thing to the United States, just as I can see why the Russians would want to suggest to the United States a renegotiation of the strategic architecture in Europe, the security architecture in Europe. But in truth, I don't believe that the Americans are really interested. And even if they did agree to proposals of that kind, I can't imagine that they would take them very seriously or abide with them over the long term. A better sense of American foreign policy and of how it's being conducted at the moment comes from the secret, or it's not so secret anymore, visit by the CIA director, John Radcliffe, to Cuba, which took place apparently about a week ago. The Cubans were apparently offered another tanker with oil from Russia, and the tanker did sail close to Cuba, but apparently it was turned away. There are still powerful forces in Cuba, I suspect, that still want to come to some kind of understanding with the Americans in preference to an understanding with the Russians. This is a big topic which I'm going to discuss more fully in some other place. But Director Radcliffe came. He made a series of astonishing demands of the Cubans. He said that Cuba must stop all its foreign policy contacts with American adversaries, China, Iran, and of course, Russia. It must essentially subordinate its entire economy to US economic interests. It must carry out root and branch reforms of the existing political system in Cuba, which would basically end the political system that Cuba has had since the Castro Revolution of 1959. And apparently Radcliffe came to Cuba with no indication at all that he was prepared to compromise or give ground about anything. And the US is making these demands in the full knowledge, of course, that the situation in Cuba without the Russian oil is rapidly becoming critical again. And as was set out in a very fine article on Naked Capitalism, that regime change in Cuba appears to be finally within America's reach. So that, I suspect, is the real face of American diplomacy. When they come up against the Chinese and the Russians, great powers, they pull back, but they do so without any real conviction. They can't bring themselves to negotiate with Iran, which they don't consider to be a great power. And with countries like Venezuela and Cuba, they insist on essentially subordination and will accept nothing else. This is not diplomacy in the commonly understood way in which that has been practiced since modern diplomacy began to evolve in 17th century Europe. And sooner or later, perhaps sooner or later, it's going to lead to a smash, much worse, I suspect, than the smash we've just seen in Iran, with Iran. I hope, by the way, that that can be avoided. But some of the rhetoric about China from people like Bolton or indeed Rubio makes me think that a clash with China is indeed coming. Anyway, that's where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.